Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum.
Et c'est un très grand plaisir pour moi de vous présenter notre conférencier Charles Larmor, qui nous vient de Brown University, contrairement à ce qui est affirmé sur sa page, enfin sa page, la page Wikipédia, où il est annoncé encore comme professeur à Columbia. Ça, c'était vrai jusqu'en 97. Et par contre, comme l'affirme cette page, c'est quelqu'un qui a le mérite de s'exprimer dans un français exemplaire, je cite. Il est l'auteur d'un grand nombre de contributions philosophiques, plus d'une demi-douzaine de livres, dont « Modernité et morale » ou plus récemment « The Autonomy of Morality ». Et il travaille, selon une autre de ses pages qui nous informe à son sujet, sur un livre concernant la nature de la liberté. Je ne vais pas en dire plus, parce que le texte est long et il va falloir lui laisser la parole. Donc, c'est à toi. Merci.
Merci, Christine. C'est un très grand plaisir pour moi d'être de nouveau ici à Montréal. Je regrette que je n'ai pas de version française de ce texte que je vais présenter. Et je regrette aussi que le texte est très, très long, monstrueusement long. Et je ne vais pas lire tout le texte en anglais. J'ai essayé de couper un peu. Donc, l'ensemble est 45 pages. Je ne vais pas lire 45 pages. J'ai coupé une dizaine de pages. Tout de même, je crois que ce que je vais lire est un peu long. Je sollicite votre patience. Mais évidemment, la discussion après pourra avoir lieu en français ou en anglais, comme vous voulez. Donc, mais je vais commencer en anglais. Morality is what makes us human. One meaning of this common saying is plain enough. Refraining from injury to others, keeping our word, helping those in need, constitute the elementary decencies of society. If most of us do not observe them most of the time, or at least give one another the impression of doing so, no one would have the security to pursue a flourishing life. Even a life of basic dignity would be impossible if we found ourselves continually at the mercy of aggression, treachery, and indifference. Morality makes us human by providing rules of mutual respect, without which there can be neither social cooperation nor individual achievement. However, another meaning suggests itself as well. That is, the idea of morality is what makes us human. It has to do not with morality's function, but with its source. Other animals are like us in being able to show deference and feel affection, even to the point of sacrificing themselves for those whom they love. But morality, insofar as it involves looking beyond our own concerns and allegiances in order to respect others in and of themselves, lies beyond their ken. Does not then our very ability to think morally point to a peculiarly human power of self-transcendence, a power that we alone among the animals have of regarding ourselves from the outside as but one among others, and that finds in morality, if not its only, then certainly its most striking expression? This question engages our attention far less than it should. When people, philosophers included, wonder about the nature of morality, they tend to focus on what reasons there may be to be moral, what acting morally entails, or in what sense, if any, moral judgments count as true or false. All of these are important issues. But often, the taken for granted deserves the greatest scrutiny. It sounds like Heidegger, but anyway. That we should be able at all to view the world impersonally, recognizing the independent and equal standing of others, involves an overcoming of self that is no less remarkable for having become largely second nature. Among philosophers, Kant was one of the few, and perhaps the most famous, to argue directly that morality is in this sense what makes us human. I quote him from the Second Critique, "Duty, sublime and mighty name, what is an origin worthy of you? Only a freedom," he replied, "that, as he said, elevates man above himself as a part of the world of sense, a freedom and independence from the mechanism of all of nature." Our moral consciousness, according to Kant, testifies to the freedom we alone have to rise above all that experience has made of us so that we may act in accord with demands we understand as binding on us independently of our given interests and desires. I believe, like many, that Kant was on the track of an essential truth. But like many, too, I do not believe that the source of morality can be anything so extravagant, if morality itself is not to be an illusion, as a freedom unshaped by the course of experience. Freedom, in any form we can conceive, depends not only on external conditions proving conducive to our ends, but also on our having acquired, through training and effort, the abilities necessary for exercising control over ourselves and the world. After all, we have to learn how to think morally, which means developing a sense of social expectations, as well as the self-discipline needed to distinguish the good of others from our own, or from what we wish their good would be. Thus, Kant's intuition needs to be brought down to earth. One proposal might be that the capacity for self-transcendence, to which morality gives expression, consists in our nature as normative beings, responsive not merely to the causal impress of the environment, but to the authority of reasons as well. To see that we have a reason to think or act in a certain way is to see that we ought to do so, all other things being equal. And heeding an ought, as is clear with the moral ought, means holding ourselves to a demand we regard as binding upon us. Why is not this subordination of self the self-transcendence at issue? Certainly, morality is not possible except for beings that can respond to reasons. Yet the ought is not limited to the moral realm, any more than it is true that the only reasons for action we have are moral in character. Most importantly, the subordination of self involved in the recognition of reasons as such falls importantly short of the way that morality asks us to look beyond ourselves. Suppose, for instance, that we are pursuing some interest of our own or the good of some people we hold dear, and doing so solely because that interest or those people matter to us. The reasons we then perceive to act one way rather than another are ones we would have to agree that anyone similarly disposed would have in such circumstances. All reasons are universal, binding on one person only if binding on all of whom the same conditions are true that make them applicable to the first person. That is what it is for reasons to be binding, and why responding to reasons means holding ourselves responsible to the authority of an ought, distinct from our individual will. Nonetheless, this subordination of self is not the self-transcendence that morality demands, for the reasons in question only apply to us because we care about those ends. Their authority, though real, remains conditional. Imagine, however, that we think we ought to help someone simply because that person is in distress. Perhaps it is someone whom we happen to hold dear, but we are attending not to the love we feel, but only to the person's suffering. Reasons of this sort are not just universal, as all reasons are, they are impersonal as well, applying to us in abstraction from our own interests and affections. Or more exactly, their applicability does not depend on any such personal factors insofar as the latter are identified as ours, since it is possible to have an impersonal reason to satisfy a desire of ours if the desire, understood solely as belonging to a person like any other, turns out to warrant attention. In short, impersonal reasons derive from the way things are in and of themselves, as in the imagined case, from another person's actual condition. And it is just this impersonal element that constitutes the hallmark of moral reasons for action. Thus, acknowledging the force of reasons is not, by itself, sufficient to impel us to look beyond ourselves in the way that morality requires. Nor is it, incidentally, a distinctively human capacity. Many of the higher animals also have, or can be trained to have, a sense of how they ought to behave. My dogs do, anyway. Yet moral thinking, the grasping of impersonal reasons, remains beyond their reach, despite my best ability to turn my dogs into moral creatures. They have not got there yet. Precisely this last point suggests the direction of a more promising approach. Though other animals can respond to reasons, they appear for the most part unable to reflect about what they ought to do, evaluating and weighing the reasons they see to favor one option or another. Reflection seems basically beyond their reach, if by reflection is meant standing back so as to regard ourselves from the outside as we do someone else in order to figure out who we are or what we ought really to think or do. Why is it not then our capacity for reflection to which morality gives special expression? Are we not better able to consider others as persons in their own right, apart from the personal concerns that color our perception of the world, the more reflective distance we achieve toward ourselves? Of course, as that question implies, reflection need not always be impersonal. Sometimes we reflect by asking ourselves what someone close to us would think about our situation. But herein lies a strength of the approach I'm proposing. For now, the freedom that is integral to morality becomes intelligible. It is the ability to overcome the hold that a natural absorption in our own affairs exercises over our thinking, in order to see the intrinsic value in the good of others. And it manifestly grows out of the less impartial ways we have of standing back from ourselves. Impersonal reflection is a creature of experience, and a more sensible answer than Kant's to what it is that constitutes our peculiar power of self-transcendence. Morality is not, of course, the only example of impersonal reflection, any more than it could be the only example of the non-empirical freedom that Kant postulated. When we reflect upon what we should believe about a certain matter and ask, not what we are inclined to suppose or what our friends or community would conclude, but rather what the facts themselves require, we are reflecting impersonally. For our target, then, consists in impersonal reasons for belief, reasons, in parallel to impersonal reasons for action, that we grasp as binding on us independently of our desires and loyalties, because based on what we know to be true about the subject matter itself. Morality, however, provides a privileged expression, a privileged illustration, of our capacity for impersonal reflection. For what could be a more conspicuous expression of our ability to stand back from our own attachments, as though we were merely one person among many, than to consider other people's good as of equal moment with ours, particularly when it is to our personal disadvantage? In this talk, I want to examine more deeply the way that reflection serves as the source of our moral thinking. How is it that by viewing ourselves from without, we can learn to see others as having an equal claim on our attention? Reflection, as I've said, need not always assume an impersonal form. What then is involved in its coming to exhibit the sort of self-transcendence that morality demands? Obviously, the place to begin is the nature of reflection itself. Those who are following in the text, as I see some of you are, I'm skipping to the next section, number 2. It is the human condition that we rarely exist at one with ourselves. Often we feel torn between competing commitments, or no sooner do we make some decision of moment than we recall our doubts about whether a different option might not be better. To deliberate honestly is to risk having a mind divided, for our inner conflicts seldom amount to mere confusions vanishing in the wake of a more careful scrutiny. Generally, they mirror the real complexity of our situation, the multiplicity of demands that rightly exercise a hold on our attention. Even when we conclude that we have good reason to take one path rather than another, we leave behind something of ourselves in the possibilities we reject. Yet conflict is not the only or the deepest way in which we fail to coincide with ourselves. Even more fundamental is our continual alternation between doing and reflecting. We move back and forth between two standpoints, the view from within and the view from without. Each of us having a life that is ours alone to live, we naturally approach the world in the light of the interests and allegiances that happen to be ours. So long as everything goes its customary way, we think and act from within our own perspective. Yet we are also often moved to reflect on our thought and action, not for the pure pleasure of doing so, but because some problem has emerged that puts into question the way we have been proceeding. We are no longer clear about the sort of person we are, or about what we should believe or do with regard to some other matter. Reflection is the response to a problem, the attempt to reestablish a fit between expectation and reality. Reflecting also means, however, ceasing to live our lives from within in order to look at ourselves from without. To be sure, we stand back so as to examine the particular difficulty that has arisen. But even if it is something quite circumscribed, some trait of ours, not the shape of our life as a whole, and even if it concerns an object distinct from us, the real character of someone else, or the confusing nature of some natural or social phenomenon, it is still ourselves, and not merely the difficulty, that we regard from the outside. As a response to a problem that has disturbed our routine, reflection is always a turning back upon ourselves, since it aims to figure out what we are to do about the difficulty before us. It requires us, moreover, to look at ourselves from without, since ascertaining what we ought to do means discovering what solution we have reason to adopt. Reasons being necessarily universal, as I said earlier, if binding on one, then binding on all under similar conditions, we cannot determine how we should proceed except by considering what anyone in our shoes ought to do. Naturally, we do not forget that in the case at hand, we are the target, since our question remains, what should we do? But we approach this question, in effect, if not in so many words, by asking ourselves how anyone like us ought to think or act. When we simply respond to reasons without reflecting, we do not take this sort of detour. But deliberating about what reasons we may have is a different matter. That is the essence of reflection, and it requires us to regard ourselves as one person among others, from without, though not necessarily, as will become clear, from an impersonal distance. Skipping to the top of page 11 for those following. Now, despite the difference between living our lives from within and reflecting on them from without, it would obviously be wrong to suppose that reflection stands opposed to life. Rousseau made some remarks that kind of suggested that, but that would be silly to suppose that. Or that it constitutes a luxury or a corruption, Rousseau, we might choose to forgo. A reflecting animal is a depraved animal, isn't that what Rousseau said? We become the persons we are through the problems we confront. There's no end to the need for standing back, and we live as much outside ourselves, thinking about what we should do, as within the various activities we do pursue. Indeed, little in the way we see the world around us fails to show the mark of what we have learned by reflecting. That is why a concern for others, though it has its roots in reflection, forms an important part of our everyday lives. Internalizing what we have learned, we come to act with an eye to the well-being of those, family, friends, and associates, about whom we care enough to have considered how they feel. Similarly, we incorporate into our dealings with others moral principles we've acquired by reflecting impartially on how one should in general treat one's fellow human beings. What I am calling the view from within is not essentially self-interested. Nonetheless, the business of living easily keeps us in the pool of our own orbit. This we often discover if we happen to reflect anew. For reflection knows no inherent limits. It allows us to make out the ways the very habits of mind we have acquired by reflecting still remain tied to the particularities of our life. Thus we recognize, on taking a broader view, that our various loyalties and loves are likely to matter little to others with their own lives to live, their own ties and causes. Even the moral principles we espouse may appear a bit parochial or biased once we consider the extent to which they have been shaped by culture or class. Now, as I've previously remarked, reflection can proceed from more than one type of standpoint of evaluation. It need not aim at being impersonal, that is, at judging how we ought to think or act irrespective of our own interests and attachments. We may, for instance, base our evaluation of the options before us on what we imagine some individual, real or fictional, whom we hold dear would do in our place or would want us to do. Philosophers tend to neglect this mode, non-impersonal, a mode of reflection, perhaps because they believe themselves to be above it, but they are certainly wrong to do so. All of us lean from time to time on various exemplars, internalized heroes and idols, to figure out how we ought to think and act. Moreover, modeling ourselves on others is not in itself a vice, as though the proper course were always to think on our own. Everything depends on the worth of the models to which we appeal. Though it is often simple chance or some special allure that has led them to represent for us the kind of person we would like to be, this too is not necessarily deplorable. We may not have the time or the means to check their reliability. And even when we do, some particular trait of theirs may later prove instructive in ways we could not anticipate when confirming their general value. So little is identifying with others an appropriate object of disapproval, it plays an essential role in our coming to grasp the impersonal point of view. The capacity for reflection does not spring full-blown from anyone's head. It develops over time. In early life, reflection upon who we are and what we should do consists quite naturally in imagining what those who are close to us would say. As our horizons broaden and we discover that parents and friends disagree, we find ourselves impelled to derive more abstract angles of evaluation. And thus we come to examine ourselves by the standards of some larger community to which we feel bound. But the same factors tend to push us beyond that perspective as well. And thus we may eventually fashion the idea of a fully informed and perfectly rational standpoint, transcending the limitations in the attitudes of particular individuals and societies, though even then, identification is not at an end, since generally we do so by looking in our own culture for exemplars of such an impersonal standpoint to take as our models. Only through this sort of process do we learn what it is to hold ourselves accountable to an impersonal standard of thought and action. Only thus can we come to grasp the specifically moral point of view, which is to see in another's good, separately from our own interests and attachments, a reason for action on our part. Whether we assume the outlook of some other individual or reflect instead from an impersonal standpoint, certain elements remain constant, however. One is that reflection aims, in response to a problem, at determining what we have reason to think or do. Now, reasons, as I've pointed out, are universal in character. If binding on us, then binding on all who find themselves in conditions similar to those that make them applicable to us. It follows that even when we reflect, not impersonally, but by identifying with the standpoint of someone we esteem, our conclusions are still ones we must assume that anyone like us ought to endorse in such a situation. That is not an awkward implication. For would we adopt that standpoint if we did not presume it attuned to how people should really behave who have interests like those that impel us to take it up? If I pattern my wardrobe on what some movie star wears, not counterfactual example, if I pattern my wardrobe on what some movie star wears, I'm assuming that he knows how people who want to be cool ought to dress. Another constant is that in reflecting, we have to rely on our current understanding of the world. We cannot regard ourselves from without except by continuing to think, at least in part, from within the perspective we presently occupy. Precisely because reflection is the response to a problem, it is always situated. Only in the light of our existing views can we so much as identify the problem before us, and we cannot hope to handle it except by drawing upon the relevant information at our disposal. When we reflect by imagining what someone important to us would say, we make use, for example, of what we understand to be that person's characteristic habits of mind. So too, when we consider impersonally what we ought to think or do, we base ourselves on the knowledge we've acquired, not only of the matter before us, but also more broadly, of how beliefs should be proportioned to evidence, or of how people are to be treated fairly. The impersonal point of view is not the view from nowhere. It always bears the mark of our time and place. And yet, I must add, its claim to being impersonal does not thereby come to be a sham. Our access to reality, as it is in itself, is always mediated through the contingencies of history. This is not the place to enter into a discussion of epistemological questions, but the general position to which I'm alluding is easily summarized. Impersonal reasons, I've said, are reasons that stem solely from facts outside of us, uncolored by our own interests and attachments. Though reflecting on what impersonal reasons we have certainly entails appealing to our existing conception of those facts,
our conclusions are still valid precisely to the extent that the beliefs on which we rely, for all their rootedness in the prior course of our experience, constitute knowledge of the matter at hand. To be sure, we may be wrong about their reliability, but that just means that our ideas concerning what impersonal reasons we have are always revisable, which is neither surprising nor ruinous. Impersonal reflection is, after all, an achievement, and consequently, the object of constant scrutiny for lingering traces of bias or distortion. At this point, however, there arises some crucial questions. Does reflection, impersonal or not, really aim at truth? Is it an organ of knowledge? And if so, what can it provide knowledge of? These questions would appear to admit of a ready answer. We reflect in order to be able to discern how it is that we ought to think or act in the given circumstances, and that seems clearly to count as an object of knowledge. For it is something of which we begin by feeling ignorant and seek, by reflecting, to gain a correct grasp. What we ought to do is tantamount to what there is reason for us to do. So reflection, in essence, aims at knowledge of reasons for belief and action. Such a conception results from taking literally the way we ordinarily talk about reflection, and in my view, it ought to be no cause for alarm, but many disagree. In their eyes, it entails an untenable metaphysics, and is in any case untrue to the nature of reflection. To suppose that reflection's relation to reasons is one of knowledge means not only attributing to the world a domain of irreducibly normative fact, but also imagining that knowledge by itself could ever move us to action, as reflection manifestly does. Belief by itself is motivationally inert, so it's said, and can lead us to act only in conjunction with some additional cognitive element of the mind, such as a desire or a commitment. This is what people say, it's not what I say. Reflection, that is therefore claimed, is a practical rather than a theoretical enterprise. When we reflect on what we have reason to do, our purpose is to settle how we want to live, not to discover some fact about the world. So to this set of claims, I now turn. Now, reasons for belief and action are essentially normative in character. What we have reason to do is what we ought to do, all else being equal. There's no explaining what is meant by reasons except by appeal to this or similarly normative ways of speaking. Reasons cannot therefore be equated with any features of the natural world, physical or psychological, even if they certainly depend on the natural facts being as they are. That is why many philosophers balk at allowing that reasons can properly count as objects of knowledge. If knowledge is of what is the case anyway, independent of our coming to hold a view about it, then supposing that reasons figure among the things we can know entails that the world, as the totality of what is the case, must include normative facts about how we ought to think and act. Such a view runs contrary to the naturalism that constitutes the reigning philosophical orthodoxy of our day. All that really exists, it is said, belongs to the domain of the natural sciences, the realm of physical fact, or of psychological fact, too, if the latter is not further reducible to the physical. As should be plain, I reject this sort of naturalism, but my main business here is to clarify the character of reasons and to explain why we should conceive of reflection as a way of acquiring knowledge about them. Consider then first why it is that a reason cannot consist in a physical state of affairs. We sometimes say that the rain, the snow, or the fact that it is raining is a reason to take an umbrella when leaving the house. But strictly speaking, my reason to do so is not the rain itself, but rather a certain relation that the rain bears to my possibilities of action. After all, one might agree that it is raining, yet dispute that this fact gives me a reason to take an umbrella. Only insofar as the rain justifies or counts in favor of carrying an umbrella, does it take on the status of a reason. And this status, the relation of counting in favor of, is not a physical quality of the rain. It's a normative attribute. The rain is a reason to take an umbrella means the same as, given the rain, I ought to take an umbrella. To be sure, Other things may count in favor of not taking one, of wearing a hat instead, or just getting wet. As a rule, reasons are in themselves pro tanto, as are the oughts to which they correspond. Only if they are not outweighed by contrary considerations do they indicate what we overall have reason or ought to do. The point is that whether pro tanto or decisive, reasons are not identical with the physical facts that may give rise to them. So too, the reason people have to believe this or do that is not the same as any psychological state in which they find themselves. In particular, it is not, contrary to a widespread view, going back to Donald Davidson, for example, a reason is not a combination of a belief and a desire. My reason to take an umbrella, some would say, like Davidson, consists in my belief that it is raining conjoined with my desire to keep dry. But that cannot be right. It may be true that I would not have such a reason unless I wanted to stay dry, so that in this respect, the reason is indeed conditional, binding only insofar as I have that desire, though it can also make perfect sense to say that I ought to take an umbrella against the rain whether I want to keep dry or not. But even so, the reason does not consist in the desire as such, but rather in the fact that the desire counts in favor of getting an umbrella. After all, I might have the desire, stay dry, and still no reason to fetch an umbrella, if, for example, the rain, unbeknownst to me, has ceased. Moreover, what makes it true that the desire favors that action is not my belief that it's raining, as though that a reason were constituted by that belief conjoined in some appropriate way with the desire. The reason to take an umbrella depends in no way on my believing that it is raining. It is the fact that it is raining that gives rise to the reason. For if you learned that the weather has just improved, you would inform me that I really have no reason to fetch my umbrella, even though clearly I still believe, wrongly, that it's raining. In short, a reason is the possible object of a belief and not itself a mental state. It is then their, excuse me, to page 19 for this one. It is then their essentially normative character that precludes identifying reasons with any physical or psychological facts. As a consequence, they can have no place in the world itself as naturalistically conceived. This, as I've said, is one main line of argument leading many philosophers to deny, be it implicitly or as a matter of doctrine, that reflection about what we ought to think or do can rightly count as a mode of knowledge. Conclusions about the reasons we have are not, it is held, really descriptive in intent, but serve instead to embody or announce our commitments for dealing with the world around us. After all, this is meant to be a corroborating argument, knowledge alone cannot move us to act as reflection is geared to do. The judgments we make about what we ought to think or do are practical, not theoretical in nature. It's a sign of how thoroughly modern philosophy has absorbed the naturalistic worldview that the otherwise rival schools of Hume and of Kant, which occupy so much of the terrain, are each impelled to embrace this view of reflection. The reflection is practical, not theoretical. Expressivists in the Humean tradition construe normative judgments of the form A ought to X, not as aiming to describe correctly the reasons X has, but as simply expressing our acceptance of a norm entailing that A conduct himself thus in the given circumstances. I'm alluding here, for example, to Alan Gibbard's analysis of normative judgments. Reflection is seen as charged with making clear to ourselves what norms we want in this sense to endorse, or what the norms we do endorse entail in a given situation. Kantians may differ from Humeans in their eagerness to deduce internal constraints governing the sorts of rules we can in this way coherently make our own, constraints that supposedly amount to the basic features of morality. But they agree, the Kantians, that reasons cannot form part of reality itself. What we have reason to think or do is determined by principles of thought and action that we impose upon ourselves. Only through our own autonomy, say Kantians, that is, self-legislation, can the value-neutral facts of experience acquire significance for our conduct. To quote one of them, Christine Korsgaard, the ethics of autonomy is the only one consistent with the metaphysics of the modern world, that is, the naturalistic metaphysics of the modern world. This widespread view of reasons and reflection is indeed driven by metaphysical assumptions. For naturalism, one should remember, is not a conclusion of the modern natural sciences themselves, who do not claim that they exhaust all that can count as real. Global assertions of that sort are the province of philosophy. I have no objection to metaphysics as such, but I do complain when metaphysical preconceptions contradict fundamental aspects of our everyday self-understanding. And such is the case here. The notion of reasons espoused by expressivists and Kantians alike can make no sense of what it is to reflect or even to reason. Expressivists often focus on morality alone, Gibbard, Simon Blackburn, even though their task is to explain the nature of normative judgment in general. It may seem plausible that moral judgments do no more than express a certain kind of approval or disapproval of their object, given the ease with which some people can persuade themselves that moral distinctions are ultimately of our own creation. But expressivism looks far less palatable when stated in its properly universal form. Can we really believe that the canons by which we judge whether a scientific theory is true, its fit with experimental data, its coherence with existing doctrine, its performance on severe tests, have only the authority we bestow on them? If we hold that there is good reason to adhere to such principles, are we only expressing our endorsement of a norm to the effect that everyone, ourselves included, ought to abide by them, whether one happens to want to or not? Does our endorsing such a norm explain what it is to regard those principles as valid? So would say the expressivist. If we were not constrained by an allegiance to naturalism, we would surely suppose that the order of explanation is the other way around. It is the perceived validity of the principles that accounts for why we think anyone ought to adhere to them and to endorse a norm to that effect. Denying that we reflect in order to discover something we do not yet know, namely what there is reason to think or do in the given circumstances, renders the process of reflection unrecognizable. In fact, the underlying refusal to countenance the reality of reasons distorts the very nature of reason, as we can observe if we look at the parallel Kantian notion of autonomy. Kantians, whatever stripe, think of reason as self-legislating, as giving itself principles of conduct, intellectual and practical, in the light of which alone facts in the world can acquire the status of being reasons to think and act in certain ways. But reason, like any faculty of mind, has to be defined in terms of the activity that is its characteristic exercise, good old Aristotelian principle. What then could be more obvious than that reason is the faculty of reasoning? And how else can the activity of reasoning be understood except in terms of its being responsive to reasons? The most straightforward account of the nature of reason presumes, therefore, that reasons are a reality we discover, not an artifact of our ways of thinking. To be sure, we do sometimes impose rules on ourselves whose authority is of our own making, but we do so precisely because there appear to be reasons that warrant this step. If I give myself a rule never to borrow, it is in virtue of both knowing how prone I am to borrow more than I can pay back and accepting the antecedent authority of the principle that debts are to be repaid. Autonomy makes no sense as a global account of reasons. Yet what of the counter-argument, usually used by expressivists and Kantians at this point, that figuring out what reasons we have cannot consist in discovering some further facts about the way things are? Beliefs purport to represent the facts as they are, but beliefs alone, so it is held, cannot move us to act as the results of reflection typically do. When we conclude that we have reason to act in a particular way, we are thus, it's said, not reporting a discovery, but rather expressing our confidence that the conduct in question satisfies or promotes our existing needs, interests, or commitments. The word reason, says Korsgaard, refers to a kind of reflective success. Reasons, it is said, are the outcomes of reflection when carried out well, not a reality to which reflection responds. What we have reason to think or do, it said, is what we can coherently endorse as we put our thinking in order. This line of argument is a mainstay of both the Kantian and Humean traditions. Yet for all its popularity, it's rather poor, I think. First, one might note that people, other animals too, often act for reasons without reflecting. A more telling objection, secondly, is that endorsing some option on the basis of our existing convictions depends on supposing that they justify this decision, that they indeed give us reason to endorse the option. Reasons cannot be simply the output of reflective success, since success in reflecting consists precisely in how well we respond to the reasons that there are. However, the underlying error lies deeper still. It's a flawed conception of belief. Conclusions about reasons certainly serve to guide our conduct, yet this does not mean that they cannot have the character of beliefs. For belief by itself is not, in fact, motivationally inert. Consider what it is in general to believe this or that. A belief is not a feeling, say, the particular vivacity, as Hume said, with which an idea stands before the mind, nor is it the act of assenting to some proposition. It's a disposition, and one intimately connected with both the presumed truth of what is believed, since to believe that P means to believe that P is true, and with the behavior of the person whose belief it is, since we attribute beliefs to people in order to explain what they do. To believe that P, some proposition, is to be disposed to think and act in accord with the presumed truth of P. A person who has said that she believes the cat is on the mat, it walks across the mat as though nothing were there, will not normally be held to believe what she has said she believes. To be sure, the specific things a belief disposes someone to do depend on other elements in her outlook, just as it is true that one sometimes fails to heed a belief one has. So the person in question may have her reasons for ignoring the cat and may be tramping across the mat out of inadvertence. But if she believes the cat is there, then she will be moved, all other things being equal, to comport herself compatibly with what, in her view, the truth of that belief implies. Beliefs do not merely represent the way things are or consist in holding certain facts to be true. They are at once descriptive and prescriptive. Being disposed to draw appropriate inferences from what we believe is an inherent part of believing. In other words, beliefs are commitments in their own right, commitments to think and act in accord with the presumed truth of what is believed. Thus, reflection can very well aim at discovering what we have reason to do, at the same time as it serves to guide us in how to live. Its goal is to arrive at correct beliefs about the reasons we have, beliefs which themselves, like all beliefs, commit us to conducting ourselves accordingly. Reflection is inseparably both theoretical and practical. As you'll gather, I have very little patience with distinctions between theoretical and practical reason, and that's an instance. Now, so far, I've been arguing negatively against the idea that reflection cannot be an organ of knowledge, but I've yet to explain what sort of reality is constituted by the reasons for thought and action which are its objects. Here, I'll be brief. If reasons belong to the fabric of reality, they are not, to be sure, some sort of independent entities hovering alongside the more down-to-earth things we see and touch. As already suggested, reasons consist in a certain relation, the relation of counting in favor of. That features of the natural world, the physical and psychological facts making it up, bear to our possibilities of thought and action. This is a normative relation, and thus reasons cannot be equated with anything in nature. Yet, being relational, they manifestly depend on the existence of what they relate. And that means on the natural, that is, physical and psychological facts being as they are, as well as on our having possibilities of thought and action. In this sense, reasons therefore exist only because we do too. That would be peculiar to think otherwise. And it would certainly be peculiar to think otherwise. It does not follow, however, that we are the authors of the reasons there are, that they amount to the significance we bestow on those facts. That one thing counts in favor of another is a relation, a normative relation, that we discover, that we can be right or wrong about, not one we institute ourselves. Relations are in general no less real than the things they relate, when they enjoy this sort of independence from our beliefs about their existence and nature. Thus, reasons too form part of the world, understood broadly as the totality of what exists. This conception may rightly be called Platonistic, since it holds that reasons, like Plato's forms, constitute an intrinsically normative order of reality. But it's not an extravagant kind of Platonism. It doesn't suppose that reasons dwell in some Platonic heaven, unsullied by the contingencies of the world here below. On the contrary, this account follows closely our ordinary sense of what reasons are. When we suppose, as we ordinarily do, that how we ought to think and act is a matter of how the facts bear on the options before us, what we in effect mean is that reasons for belief and action are both relational and real. And when we conclude, in particular, that we have an impersonal reason to do something, what we mean is that the facts in and of themselves count in favor of that option, apart from our own interests and attachments. Theories that reduce reasons to an expression of our commitments have to devise formulas to mimic these ways of talking without taking them literally, as I do. And it's not surprising that the simulation never quite succeeds. Now, not only do reasons not exist independently of the natural world, or of us in particular, they also do not exist independently of one another. Reasons bear various logical and evidential connections to one another. Sometimes the reasons we have to do one thing is contingent on our having reason to do another. As when, thinking we have reason to believe the noise behind the bushes is a wild boar, we conclude that we have reason to climb up a nearby tree. And sometimes the reason to do a certain thing is in essence the application to particular circumstances of a far broader and standing reason, in other words, a principle, governing how we ought in general to comport ourselves. Thus, the reason we have to save part of our income, perhaps to buy a second home, I wrote this a long time ago, to pay for your first home, and to retire in some comfort, depends on our having more generally reason to be prudent and think about our long-term good. What then about the relation between moral reasons and the other sorts of considerations that move us to act? It's often been thought, both in everyday life and in moral philosophy, that acting morally needs to be shown to be ultimately in the agent's own best interest. Only if the reason to concern ourselves with another's good can be derived from the presumably more basic reason that we have to pursue our own good, can morality really be authoritative for our conduct. The philosophical proofs have taken many different forms, depending on how both the agent's good and practical rationality have been conceived. Plato, for instance, had Socrates respond to the challenge by arguing that justice, or morality alone, ensures the harmony of the soul to which we each ultimately aspire. The more common version in our own day has followed the lead of Thomas Hobbes, arguing that the adoption of principles of mutual restraint and cooperation is the most efficient means for each individual to satisfy his or her own interests over the long run, whatever they may be, given the essentials of the human condition. This is not the place, obviously, to evaluate in detail these various attempts to show how we may reason ourselves into the moral point of view from a standpoint located outside it and presumed to be more basic. Let me observe here, and not only that they all fail, for that's well known, but they fail in two distinct ways, these attempts. They do not succeed in explaining how the moral ought derives from the ought of individual prudence, duly enlightened. Even more importantly, the very understanding of morality on which they rely is typically defective, since it is slanted to fit the extra moral standing point they invoke. Consider the Hobbesian approach, as developed in our time by a great many writers. It conceives of morality as a set of rules for social cooperation, founded upon mutual advantage. The limits these rules place on the pursuit of our own ends are held to maximize our good in the long run through the interactions they permit with others, provided the others, too, comply with these restraints. Yet such a view excludes from the domain of moral concern two groups of people whom it is the business of morality to move us to treat better than we would otherwise be inclined to do. Those unlikely to come into frequent contact with us, and thus ever to contribute to our good, and those with neither the power nor the ability to enhance or jeopardize our interests in any way, however often we may cross their path. Morality conceived as a cooperative scheme for mutual benefit fails to embody so fundamental a norm as the respect we owe to strangers and to the weak. This is not, moreover, a failure to account for some marginal phenomena to be remedied by further refining the theory. For surely it belongs to the very core of our moral thinking that we are to show equal respect to those who, through circumstance or misfortune, may never be in a position to benefit us in return. Indeed, we act toward the powerful and the useful in a moral and not merely prudent fashion when we behave as we would even if they lacked those assets that make them of interest to our own endeavors. We aim then to treat them with the respect they deserve as human beings, not with the sort of circumspection we exercise in dealing with the various natural forces for good and ill in our environment. The Hobbesian idea, that extends way beyond just writings of Thomas Hobbes, the Hobbesian idea of morality reflects the notion of the rational agent concerned to pursue his own interests as efficiently as possible. The Hobbesians take as their point of departure for showing how we can reason ourselves into morality. That is why this idea is so distorted. For if, as I've assumed from the outset, I'll be explaining more detail in a bit, the moral point of view consists in seeing in another's good, in and of itself, a reason for action on our part, how could it ever come within reach of a person whose reasoning focuses essentially on satisfying his own interests? Let those other interests be as other-directed as well as self-directed, it does not matter. There is all the difference in the world between respecting or fostering another's good because one has among one's interests a particular attachment to that person, and doing so simply because that person's good is in question. It's the latter, the impersonally motivated act, that embodies the properly moral attitude. Every attempt to bring the moral point of view within the orbit of the rational pursuit of one's own concerns is bound to erase its most distinctive feature, which is the concern we conceive for another's good just because it is his or hers. We cannot then, I think, reason ourselves into an appreciation of what it is to act morally, beginning from some location outside the moral point of view. Morality has to speak for itself. It constitutes a class of reasons for action that is sui generis, unintelligible in terms of any supposedly more primitive class of reasons. This fact ought not to be disturbing, though it does have an important philosophical consequence. To understand why it does not make a mystery of moral thinking, consider the case of prudence, precisely the form of reasoning in which philosophers, no doubt others too, feel a hankering to ground morality. How would we go about changing the mind of someone who perceives no reason to be prudent, no reason to take into account, in deciding what to do, the desires that he or she will predictably have later, even if they are not his or hers at the moment? We might have some luck by exposing the erroneous assumptions that keep that person perhaps from recognizing the value of prudence, such as the notion that reasons for action cannot but be the expression of one's given desires. But if negative arguments of that sort do not work, what else can we do? There can be no prospect of reasoning the person into an acceptance of prudential reasons by appealing to some deeper set of motivations he could be presumed to possess. What would such an argument look like? That it is in his interest to be prudent? That is hopelessly circular. The fact is that prudence is just like morality. It constitutes a class of sui generis reasons for action, underivable from any more basic set of considerations. Herein lies an important philosophical lesson, I think, not just about morality, but about reflection in general. If we are to move the person who has been stubbornly refusing to listen to the voice of prudence, we can only say something like, "Think about what you will surely want 1 year from now. Don't you see that you ought to act accordingly?" In the end, people just have to acknowledge that there exist reasons of prudence. There's no way they can be led to reason themselves from some external standpoint into a sense of the value of prudence. So too with morality. We simply have to see that another's good is in itself a reason for action on our part. Reflection does not then always proceed by inferring some reasons from others with which we are already familiar. It also includes the power of acknowledging the force of reasons that speak for themselves, like the reasons to be prudent, the reasons to be moral. Such is the kind of reflection that deep shifts in our thinking typically require. Now, this conclusion may seem to contradict my earlier insistence that our capacity for reflection develops as we mature, but that's not so. When we are young, as I said, reflecting means taking up the standpoint, what we imagine to be the standpoint, of those to whom we feel close, judging ourselves and our possibilities accordingly. As our horizons broaden and we encounter conflicts among our various loyalties, we are moved to work out less partisan standards of evaluation, and thus we develop an ability to reflect impersonally on what we ought to believe and do. Yet though this process takes place step by step, it does not consist in grasping how our various interests and attachments, along with the desire to handle the tensions among them, point us to reasons for belief and action that are impersonal in character. The capacity of reflection is one thing, its objects are another. We learn to stand back from our individual commitments so as to view the world as it is in itself. But this achievement by itself leaves open what reasons, if any, we then discover about how we are to think and act. To see what reasons there are, we must actually reflect. After all, when we realize that our own good does not, absolutely speaking, matter more than the good of others, we might perhaps conclude that therefore neither theirs nor ours matter much at all. Being impartial has been known more than once to produce indifference. Some urge that if we are not to remain indifferent, we must care about how people in general fare, to be sure. Yet the ready appeal to feelings, I think, does little to illuminate the matter. I say some trepidation here, but go ahead. For why would we care, if not that we see some reason to do so? The point at issue is precisely how we come to discern such a reason. Is not, I have argued, by determining what in the long run or in the deepest sense will serve our own good. If there is a reason to care about the good of others in and of itself, it has to be one that speaks for itself when we view the world impersonally. But it is also true that impersonal reflection must also look in the right place. We need in particular to focus not on the fact that from the standpoint of the universe, no one's good matters much at all, but on the fact that each person's good matters enormously from his or her own perspective. Such, then, are the basic features of reflection, its modalities and aims. We reflect in order to figure out what we ought to think or do in response to a problem that has disrupted our usual ways of dealing with the world. To find a solution, we stand back from how we have gone on before, looking at ourselves from the outside and appraising our options from a standpoint we consider authoritative for the problem before us. The explicit object we now before our mind is what we have reason to think or do, and the reasons we seek to discover are by definition universal, if valid for us, then valid for all under similar circumstances. They are in addition impersonal if they are reasons we can grasp as binding on us independently of our own interests and attachments. With this framework in place, it's been a long time, I'm sorry, it's time to return to the main theme. We are moral beings, I have said, because of the remarkable power of self-transcendence that reflection makes possible when it becomes impersonal. We can learn how to stand back from our own concerns so as to be able to see in another's good, in and of itself, a reason for action on our part. The preceding analysis has shown what is involved in reflection taking on an impersonal form. But much more needs to be said about the role that impersonal reflection plays in our moral thinking. I have not, for instance, explained what sort of being this other is whose good appears from the moral point of view as an intrinsic object of concern. Is it any human being as such? Or is it more broadly all living beings, animals, even plants included, may be considered to possess a good? How widely does our moral responsibility extend? I've been assuming that it encompasses every human being, and that is the assumption in all that follows, but I don't suppose that our moral concern should stop at the boundaries of humanity. As to how far it should extend, I have no systematic answer, and I believe, moreover, that we should not be in a rush to devise one. Uncertainty about the scope of our moral responsibility seems to me to be in keeping with our present intellectual situation. For plainly, those traditional answers will not do that equate the objects of moral concern with those who are themselves able to take up the moral point of view. Should have restricted to, in fact, a subclass of human beings. Such is the approach adopted whenever one conceives of morality as a set of rules for social cooperation, as in the Hobbesian tradition, or as a system of reciprocal claims rational agents make upon one another, as in the Kantian tradition. And it fails because it cannot even attribute to all human beings a moral standing in their own right, not to infants, not to the mentally disabled, not to the doddering elderly, which with the advances of modern medicine, we will all have a very good chance of becoming. At best, it can award such people only a derivative status, depending on what is owed to their morally functioning trustees. Surely then, the domain of moral concern must extend beyond the domain of moral agents, and how far it does reach is a question at the frontiers of moral thinking today. What I do want to discuss in some detail here is the relation itself between impersonal reflection and morality. On several different scores, one might in fact dispute whether so intimate a connection exists between the two, impersonal reflection and morality, as I've been asserting. does the essence of the moral point of view really consist in recognizing that the good of another, purely by virtue of being a person's good, is of equal moment with our own? Skip to page 35. Now, one might immediately object that this conception of morality is a highly contentious one. Does not its insistence on impersonality and the need to stand back from our own concerns signal an allegiance, from all my rejection of the idea of autonomy, to the rigoristic distinction between duty and inclination, typical of Kantian ethics? In large part, this objection would be a misunderstanding. So far, I said nothing about moral feelings, such as sympathy, but has not been to deny their importance when we take an intrinsic interest in another person's good. Contrary to Kant, moral character does not show through most when one does what is right despite, says Kant, being cold in temperament and indifferent to the sufferings of others, since there's nothing much left for moral character to be, given that sort of insensibility. Our thinking about right and wrong takes shape through experience, in the way I sketched earlier, handling the conflicts between our various allegiances by learning to consider others from a wider perspective. And this process involves a generalization of the ability to care about how another fares that we first acquire in our relations to those who are close to us. But it is crucial to understand rightly the role feelings play. To sympathize with the pain or joy of others, at least insofar as morality is concerned, is not to feel their pain or joy ourselves, as though by a sort of contagion. It is to feel sadness at their suffering, delight at their happiness, a second order of feeling in which we express our sense that they have reason to feel as they do. Sympathy consists in being moved by the good of others. It therefore remains narrower than it might otherwise be, so long as it is filtered through our own interests and attachments. Feelings come to have a moral role precisely to the extent that they take us out of ourselves, and in this way they become indeed impersonal. Nothing, then, in the conception of morality on which I have been leaning appears peculiarly Kantian. In fact, if I had to cite a single source of inspiration, it would not be Kant, but rather Scripture, though I hasten to add that my agenda is strictly secular. In both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, we meet the precept, love thy neighbor as thyself. It contains, I believe, a profound insight into the true character of moral thinking. All of us, by nature, love ourselves, caring immensely whether our desires are satisfied and whether our lives go as we would like. Obviously, this self-love often stands in the way of our caring about others as we should. Yet it also offers a paradigm of what a concern for others would be like if we were to look beyond our own sphere, beyond, that is, our individual interests as well as the interests of those who matter to us because of their special connection to ourselves. For the conspicuous feature of self-love is not so much its magnitude, and pretty big, as its immediacy. The concern we feel for our own good is not channeled through other considerations. We do not care about our own we do not care about how our own lives go because we are someone to whom we feel particularly close, or because we hope that we will secure from ourselves some benefit in return. Each of us cares quite simply because it's me. Suppose, then, we care about another's good in the same direct, unmediated way, solely because it is his or her good. That would be, in the biblical phrase, to love thy neighbor as thyself, or in the more analytic, less inspiring language I've used, to see in another's good, in and of itself, a reason for action on our part. And such is the core of morality. A second misunderstanding, I'm bottom of 38 now, a second misunderstanding would be to suppose that if the moral point of view consists in seeing everyone's good as of equal moment, acting morally must therefore amount to acting so as to bring about the most good overall. That is not so. Nothing inherently favors this sort of consequentialist position. On the contrary, the moral point of view is in itself mute about how exactly we are to advance the good of others and adjudicate the competing claims they make on our attention. Principles of moral reasoning have to be introduced to make the moral point of view operational. That certainly is not a biblical phrase. One principle is aggregative. Giving equal consideration to each person's good can be taken to mean that in effect we should consider each person impartially as we determine what will increase the total good of all. That is precisely the consequentialist approach. But it is wrong to think, like many philosophers, that if we have a concern for other people's good, then wanting to bring about as much of it as possible is the only step that makes sense. We could instead resolve to respect each person's good as precious in its own right. Another principle, contrary, different principle, is thus not aggregative, but distributive. If each person's good is to be treated equally, at least in ways that protect and foster that person's very ability to have and pursue a conception of his or her good, then it ought not to be compromised or sacrificed even for the sake of ensuring a greater good for others. This is the underlying rationale of deontological theories, so-called, which insist on what we owe to a given person, the treatment we should, as in keeping a promise, and should never, as in doing violence, accord him, irrespective of how we could otherwise act so as to benefit others and irrespective of what others may do in response to our action. Clearly, these two ways of thinking are not the same and can lead to very different judgments about what to do. But clearly, too, sometimes the one and sometimes the other seems the natural approach to take. When a great number of people is concerned and their needs are particularly urgent, satisfying the needs of as many as possible, in other words, bringing about the most good overall, easily looks like the path to adopt. But when that is not so, or when helping the many entails doing significant harm to some, respecting the integrity of the individual tends to square better with our conscience. Sometimes, of course, we find ourselves unsure about whether, in the given situation, the one or the other stance is more appropriate. I don't believe that we should try to settle in a general way which of these two basic principles of moral reasoning, consequentialist or deontological, defines the single correct theory of morality. Each of them is a plausible interpretation of what the moral point of view means in practice. That is why it can so often appear right, depending on the situation, to base ourselves on the one instead of on the other. We do better than to recognize their common validity as well as their capacity to conflict. What ought not to be lost sight of, however, is that both the consequentialist and deontological principles, the aggregative and the distributive principles, have their basis in the impersonal perspective in which each person's good presents itself as constituting an equal reason for concern on our part. It is not that they can be somehow derived from that perspective or their content explicated in terms of that perspective alone, but they presuppose it and are not fully intelligible without it. I go to the end of the paper. Conclusion, page 44. We are moral beings because we can stand back from our individual concerns and determine by reference to the world itself, people by others no less real than ourselves, what we have reason to think and do. It's not to be sure in morality alone that we exercise this power of impersonal reflection. We do so too whenever we set about weighing the evidence for some belief without regard for what we would like to be true or for what common opinion would say. Yet nowhere does this self-transcendence show forth more vividly than when we turn our attention from our own happiness to that of another, taking the same direct interest in that person's good, just because it is his or hers, as we naturally harbor for our own. This ability to stand outside ourselves is our most distinctive trait as human beings, sets us off from the other animals. It shapes our greatest and noblest achievements. Clearly, far from all that is valuable in our lives originates from this standpoint. The love we feel for particular individuals does not derive from an impersonal consideration of their merits, as though we found them to be the most deserving of our affection. Its sources are instead the bonds of family, the transports of passion, the blossoming of chance encounters. Nonetheless, our love would not be a truly human love if it did not contain a sense of how small and fleeting an affair it is in the larger scheme of things. It'd be a very strange and inhuman love to think that your love was the center of the universe, right? Our humanity consists in this mix of commitment and distance. The devotion to our own sphere combined with the realization that it makes up but one life among many in the world. We cannot then understand the kind of beings we are, except in terms of the capacity for self-transcendence to which our moral thinking so vividly attests. Some philosophers have held that morality is a poor guide to self-understanding, since it generally disguises the narrower, more elementary motivations on which it actually draws, and never more so than when it presents itself as impersonal in character. Think Nietzsche, think Bernard Williams. But this mistrust is too hasty. Theories of the human condition, such as this one just mentioned, or any other, claim to base themselves on the facts, asking us to evaluate their truth by taking up, I'm not sure about Nietzsche, but this is certainly true of Bernard Williams, based on the facts, asking us to evaluate their truth by taking up toward our own person the same distanced attitude we assume toward the rest of mankind. That we can occupy an impersonal point of view ought not therefore to be in doubt. And the only question is whether, from such a vantage point, we can also see reason to care about another's good, simply because it is his or hers, in the same way we see an immediate reason to care about our own good. There can be no a priori way of answering this question. In fact, no other way than to go ahead and reflect to see what we find. In the end, only conscience can tell us whether morality is what it claims to be. Thanks. Merci.
Merci beaucoup pour ce texte extrêmement riche. Quand tu parles de la sympathie, tu affirmes que c'est, et j'étais bien d'accord avec ça, une sorte de tristesse à l'égard des souffrances de quelqu'un d'autre, dans le cas négatif, pour ne pas parler du cas positif, mythe Freud. Ensuite, tu ajoutes cette idée qu'on exprime notre sens, que les personnes en question ont raison de ressentir ce qu'ils ressentent. Et il me semble que c'est... Ça ne correspond pas à mon expérience de la sympathie, c'est pas quelque chose en tout cas qui est particulièrement conscient. Je pensais à des contre-exemples, c'est peut-être pas facile de formuler exactement des contre-exemples, mais si on pense à simplement une souffrance brute, quelqu'un qui est blessé, on peut ressentir une forme de sympathie par rapport à ce genre de souffrance sans que, par ailleurs, il y ait des présupposés sur le fait que la souffrance est justifiée, basée sur des raisons ou quelque chose de ce genre.
Oui, j'ai été là peut-être un peu, je suis allé un peu trop vite, mais par exemple, je pensais, quand j'ai écrit ce passage-là, je pense à des cas où, par exemple, quelqu'un fait une bêtise, et en fait une bêtise, il s'est fait du mal. Donc, il souffre maintenant et on dit, je n'ai aucune sympathie avec votre souffrance parce que vous avez subi cette souffrance à cause de cette bêtise énorme que tu as commise et que vous avez commise et vous auriez dû savoir que cette action-là aurait pu conduire à cette sorte de souffrance. Donc, je ne ressens aucune sympathie. Donc, dans ce cas-là, c'est parce qu'on croit qu'il n'a pas eu raison de faire ce qu'il a fait pour produire la souffrance qu'il subit. Tu dis que quand tu, même si sa souffrance est énorme, monstrueuse, il souffre beaucoup, même si je suis persuadé qu'il a subi cette souffrance à cause d'une bêtise énorme, qu'il a commise, je pouvais quand même ressentir de la sympathie pour lui. Oui. Je crois qu'il faut distinguer dans ce cas-là, oui. Pour la souffrance en tant que telle, indépendamment des circonstances qui ont contribué au fait de souffrir ainsi, si on prend simplement la souffrance en tant que telle, indépendamment de son origine, oui, peut-être je ressens de la sympathie pour lui.
Simplement. Je demandais même dans des cas d'émotions irrationnelles, quelqu'un qui ressent une peur qui n'est absolument pas fondée parce qu'il est phobique. Est-ce qu'on ne pourrait pas aussi, dans ce cas-là, c'est peut-être plus difficile, mais il me semble qu'il y a cette possibilité de dire que oui, ça pourrait faire sens de ressentir la sympathie à l'égard de...
Non, mais là, il faut faire attention, parce que j'aurais dû être... J'aurais dû être plus clair. C'est-à-dire qu'on peut ressentir de la sympathie pour quelqu'un si, à partir de son propre point de vue, il a raison
d'avoir cette peur, par exemple, même si moi-même, qui ne partage pas cette perspective à lui, je ne vois pas la raison que lui, il voit d'avoir peur. Donc, c'est plutôt quand on ressent de la sympathie pour quelqu'un parce qu'on juge qu'il a raison d'avoir ces sentiments-là, les raisons sont jugées d'après sa propre perspective à lui.
Oui, ça.
Parce qu'évidemment, on peut avoir de la sympathie pour des gens qui voient le monde d'une toute autre façon que soi-même.
I mean, I think your notion of placing, or the suggestion you make of placing this a set of maybe not obligations but of oughts towards other people who can't return sort of similar moral favors to the agent at the center of a conception of morality is intuitively attractive, and it's one that also is made by Frantz de Waal, who I assume you would consider to be one of your neo-Hobbesian moral philosopher, though of course he's an anthropologist, but he's had a lot of influence in recent years and in this particular school of moral thought, and I assume that that's what you're referring to when you talk about this group of Hobbesian, or in the Hobbesian tradition of ethics, what we'd also call ethical naturalists. Is that correct?
No, I should confess right away that I know the name Frantz de Waal, but I have not read anything by Frantz de Waal. No, I was thinking, you know, paradigmatically of David Gautier, but you know, there's a whole industry of which David Gautier is an exemplar. But the Hobbesian perspective, you know, goes into even someone who's not a Hobbesian but a Kantian, like Rawls, when Rawls thinks of the virtue of justice as a virtue of social cooperation, and social cooperation for mutual benefit. So this Hobbesian, so I was thinking really of philosophers, paradigmatically, as I said, David Gautier, but it's an influence that extends beyond people, beyond the bounds of people who would describe themselves as Hobbesian. John Rawls never described himself as a Hobbesian, but it's there in him too. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Yeah, but so I think then what I was, my comment probably applies as well. I mean, it's, I guess my point is a bit like previous comments, that I find the emphasis on having to have a reason not entirely the less compelling part of it. I mean, in the tradition, say, in the Hobbesian tradition you're referring to, there's a kind of a confusion between sociological accounts. I mean, Rawls himself, and so is Kohlberg, influenced by American sociology of the 1930s and 40s, Mead and so on, where the accounts of ethics that they give is strongly influenced by sociologists of a previous generation. So the kinds of accounts they give of reasons is really ones that are inspired by the sociological perspective or make sense from a sociological perspective. That's to say, moral rules play this important, or they have a social reason, that's to say, in regulating society and so on and so forth, you know, kind of considerations we're all familiar with. But to say that an individual moral agent has the same kinds of reasons is a lot less compelling, I think. And I think has to have those kinds of reasons in order to be considered a moral agent or to act morally, or however we want to put it. And I think this comes back to again, place this problem or the suggestion of placing treating others as you would be treated yourself at the center of morality. I mean, people do that, but they don't always have a reason to do that. Not the kind of reason I think that you're trying to get us to believe they're supposed to have or they do have. And again, from the perspective of ethical naturalism, I mean, de Waal, for instance, is not very clear on it, but seems to suggest that this what he also considers to be the core of morality, treating others as you would like to be treated yourself, is a kind of a secondary effect of the sociological reasons of morality, kind of like in much the same way that, say, doing philosophy is a kind of a secondary effect or an outgrowth of a more basic human capacity of, say, solving problems in the social environment or in the natural environment and so on.
It may be that I am not quite getting your question, but let me begin by saying there are two biblical phrases, and they are not to be identified. One is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I never invoke that one. That's the golden rule, right? If I remember my Sunday school correctly, that's the golden rule, right? You know, la règle d'or. You know? That's not what I'm invoking. That is a norm of reciprocity. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's almost a pithy statement of the idea of morality as a system of social cooperation. That was not the biblical maxim that I was invoking. I was invoking a quite different one. Love another, love thy neighbor as oneself, as thyself. Right? That's not the same thing as the do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, it sounded as though you were saying that when many people act and perhaps think of themselves as acting morally and are judged by others as acting morally, these are people who don't have as a reason for their action this maxim of doing well by others so that they will do well by you. I actually quite agree with that. There are some people, of course, who, for various reasons, come to think of their moral actions in those ways, probably because they've read a few philosophy books of the bad sort, I would add. Right? But I think that many times people do well by others just because they're genuinely concerned about the welfare of others, right? When you take the example of the supererogatory act, when one sees the catastrophe in Haiti and feels obligated to contribute money, it's not because one's hoping that if such a thing ever happened to Canada, the Haitians would chip in, but rather that this is something horrible in and of itself, the ill that's been done to these people, and I want to help in some way I can just because it's an ill that, a harm that I want to do something to remedy. So that in fact what is motivating many people's wish to contribute in that case is just that they see in another person's good or ill a reason for action on their part, quite immediately, unmediated by any consideration of how that might in the long term benefit them or how, you know, other people might think well of them in their own community. Of course, some people are like that. Some people no sooner make a contribution to a charitable cause than they tell all their friends about the contribution they've made to the charitable cause. And about such people, one has suspicions about their motivations. But if you mean that very often people do what they themselves, on reflection, though not reflecting at the time perhaps, and what other people on reflection would say is a moral action, they just do it immediately out of concern for another person's good or ill, then that's exactly the kind of view that I'm putting forward. But they see, perhaps not by reflecting on it, but they see in another person's good or ill a reason for action on their part. It's possible to see reasons for action without reflecting on there being those reasons for action. I think you can't make sense of any kind of intentional action, or for that matter, can't make sense of action, because all action is intentional, without supposing that it's action for reasons. Although that does not imply at all that the agent must be aware, much less that the agent must have reflected upon the reasons that he or she has for acting.
But it does still doesn't speak to my comment, which I think is simply that okay, that's those are people's motivations for relieving others' suffering. But it's not that's not the kind of reason most philosophers are going to find very satisfying. I mean, it's either trivial, or a lot more needs to be said about it.
Yeah, well, I think philosophers. There's certain sort of tricks of the not tricks of the trade. There's certain habits of mind that philosophers absorb from philosophy 101 and the great classics of the tradition, which sometimes are good habits and sometimes are very bad habits, right? One habit is to try to, get something out of nothing, to try to begin with really, really abstract formal premises and derive substantive conclusions. I mean, when you think about it, it's not going to work because, ex nihilo nihil, right? But it doesn't stop philosophers from trying to begin with some, for example, with the nature of reason, and then derive moral obligations from the very nature of reason, to try to proceed from the formal to the substantive. Still goes on. Yeah? Christine Korsgaard, for example. So that's one bad habit. Another bad habit is this kind of reductionist. Well, it's kind of a bad habit. What I was going to say is, let's just call it a bad habit to begin with, then I'll qualify my statement. To try to explain something in terms of something else. Now, sometimes that works, and it doesn't hurt to try if to explain one thing in terms of another. But you should be willing to countenance the fact that some things can't be explained in terms of anything more basic. As Bishop Butler said, some things are what they are and not another thing. Right? And you can't give a reductionistic account of them. And I think morality, or the moral point of view, is in fact one such sui generis, as I said, area of experience and thinking. Now, perhaps it would not have been good for the history of philosophy to begin with a philosopher saying you can't explain morality in terms of anything deeper. It's good that, you know, Glaucon issued the challenge he did to Socrates and started the tradition of philosophical ethics when Glaucon said to Socrates, show us that the just man is the happier man, right? It was good because that way you got 2,000 years of people trying to do this thing. We learned a lot from their failures. But now that we can see their failures, I think we can generalize. It's not going to work. And it shouldn't be surprising or alarming that it's not going to work, because there are areas of value other than morality which are similarly sui generis, such as the very area of normative thinking to which philosophers have a hankering to reduce moral thinking, namely prudential thinking. So that was the example that I gave in the talk. So philosophers like to do that too, reduce one thing to another. So the kind of view that I'm putting forward here when I say morality speaks for itself, I mean, there are a couple of people who said that sort of thing. Rousseau said it, or more exactly, the Savoyard vicar said it in Book 4 of Émile. But that's not the usual way that philosophers want to approach the question of morality. They want to explain morality in terms of something else. So I agree. It's not the way most philosophers approach the matter.
Juste pour revenir sur le même débat, ça nous éloigne peut-être de la conférence en tant que telle, mais ce que je me demandais, en fait, c'est est-ce que ta position fait en sorte que, en quelque sorte, tout ce qu'on appelle la tradition contractualiste, Rousseau mis à part, étonnamment, mais tout ce qu'on appelle la tradition contractualiste, en fait, ce n'est pas tellement que tu es en opposition par rapport à cette tradition, c'est que tu juges qu'elle est insuffisante par rapport aux motivations des agents. Donc autrement dit, pour pouvoir savoir si les agents vont avoir des raisons d'agir, il ne s'agit pas simplement de vérifier quel est don d'être neutre par rapport aux raisons pour lesquelles ils veulent coordonner leurs actions, mais il s'agit de savoir exactement pourquoi, qu'est-ce qui pousse un agent à agir à l'égard, dans un cadre donné, donc dans un cadre évidemment où il y a d'autres personnes, et qu'est-ce qui le pousse à agir sans savoir exactement s'il en tirera un gain ou non, ou si son action sera bien reçue ou non, mais tout simplement parce qu'il sent qu'il doit bien agir. Donc en quelque sorte, ta position pourrait très bien s'intégrer, elle n'est pas, c'est l'interprétation que j'en ferai, elle n'est pas nécessairement anticontractualiste, mais c'est plutôt que le contractualisme tel qu'il offre des raisons d'agir aux agents, que ce soit une école comme celle de Rouse ou une école comme celle de Gautier, ne te semble pas suffisante, ne te semble pas une bonne manière d'interpréter les motivations pour les agents d'entrer dans un rapport positif les uns avec les autres.
Non, est ma réponse. C'est-à-dire, à mon avis, la tradition contractualiste est insuffisante non seulement d'un point de vue motivationnel, mais du point de vue des principes de la morale. C'est-à-dire la tradition des théories contractualistes ne peuvent pas expliquer ou rendre compte du contenu de la morale. Laissons de côté les motivations. Parce que d'abord, il faut dire, comme tu l'aurais deviné, moi je ne fais pas de grande distinction entre motivation et contenu, parce que, à mon avis, si on a des croyances concernant le contenu de la morale. Ces croyances suffisent pour motiver les gens de se comporter d'une manière correspondante. Mais non, l'insuffisance de la tradition contractualiste consiste en ce qu'elle dit des principes de la morale. Parce qu'une théorie contractualiste qui regarde la morale comme une sorte d'accord, que cet accord soit hypothétique ou réel, ça ne fait pas de différence. Un accord entre des gens qui peuvent céder mutuellement corrompt la nature de la morale. D'abord, comme je l'ai dit, parce que cette conception de la morale ne peut pas expliquer pourquoi nous croyons que nous avons des devoirs moraux à l'égard de gens qui ne peuvent pas nous aider de quelque façon, ou que ce soit qu'il s'agisse de gens qui sont des étrangers, que nous voyons une fois de la vie et jamais plus, ou des gens qui sont tellement faibles qu'ils ne sont pas en mesure de nous aider, de nous bénéficier de quelque façon que ce soit. Mais deuxièmement, si on a une attitude morale à l'égard des gens qui peuvent nous bénéficier de quelque façon, cette attitude morale, si elle est authentiquement morale, doit être conçue indépendamment des bénéfices que, hypothétiquement, ces gens pouvaient nous donner. Si je te traite avec du respect, pour le dire tout simplement, si je te traite avec respect, c'est que je te traite comme un être humain digne d'un certain traitement de ma part, indépendamment de ce que tu pourrais faire à mon égard dans l'avenir. Si je calcule mon traitement à ton égard sur l'hypothèse que éventuellement tu pourrais me traiter d'une façon aussi bénéfique, ou que d'autres gens qui voient que je te traite avec respect me traiteront du respect parce qu'ils conçoivent que nous faisons tous partie d'une même communauté morale, c'est une corruption de la perspective morale. Parce que si je te traite avec du respect moral, c'est un respect qui est indépendant de ce que toi ou d'autres pourraient faire à mon égard dans l'avenir. Donc je crois que je rejette entièrement, je rejette à plusieurs égards la tradition contractualiste, mais c'est sûrement à cet égard-ci que je le rejette, c'est une corruption de la pensée morale. Oui. Donc, de toute façon, ce n'est pas que, à mon avis, que la tradition contractualiste est insuffisante sur le plan motivationnel. Elle est fausse. Voilà. Elle est fausse en ce qui concerne le contenu de la morale.
Je vais terminer avec une question qui est un peu moins secondaire, je crois. Mm-hmm. C'est pour mieux comprendre les rôles respectifs de la réflexion et des sentiments. Dans ta conception. En gros, on pourrait se poser la question de savoir comment je peux découvrir ou savoir que le bien d'un plant de carotte ou d'une personne compte. Et quand tu as commencé à parler de ça, je me suis dit non, c'est pas la réflexion qui va seulement nous permettre de réaliser ce genre de choses. Je me suis dit peut-être qu'il va parler des sentiments, et tu l'as fait. Mais je n'ai pas bien compris exactement quel était le rôle. Tu semblais avoir quand même quelques réticences par rapport aux sentiments, parce que tu nous disais qu'il fallait, disons, être prudent en faisant appel aux sentiments. Je n'ai pas bien compris quel était le rôle des sentiments, si tu pouvais le préciser, et si tu pourrais confirmer cette idée que ce n'est certainement pas la réflexion toute seule qui permet d'arriver à ce genre de conclusion. La réflexion à elle seule qui permettrait d'arriver, si on suppose l'existence d'un être dénué de tout sentiment, est-ce qu'il pourrait se rendre compte de l'importance du bien d'un plant de carotte ou d'une personne selon les cas de figure envisagés.
Oui. Ce que je n'aime pas dans les théories sentimentalistes de la morale, c'est leur idée que les sentiments expliquent quelque chose. Je nie pas que notre pensée morale est imprégnée de sentiments, mais je crois que le sentiment en tant que tel n'explique pas beaucoup. Parce que moi, j'ai une conception plutôt cognitive des sentiments. Les sentiments sont une façon que nous avons de nous apercevoir des états de choses dans le monde. Une façon qui est à plusieurs égards irremplaçable, c'est-à-dire si nous n'avons pas certains sentiments, nous sommes dépourvus de certaines informations concernant le monde lui-même ou ce que font ou ce que ressentent les autres. Mais la fonction des sentiments, dans ce cas-là, c'est de nous dévoiler des faits qui sont pertinents pour notre pensée et notre action. Donc, je ne fais pas de... Quand je parle d'une morale impartiale, je ne fais pas de distinction entre impartialité et sentiment. Je crois qu'une pensée impartiale est toujours imprégnée de sentiments. Il n'y a pas de distinction à faire là. Mais le rôle des sentiments, c'est d'être un organe, c'est ça? Un organe pour nous dévoiler des faits qui sont pertinents pour notre action. Donc, quand toi tu dis, ce n'est pas la réflexion toute seule, mais aussi le sentiment qui joue le rôle, c'est précisément cette distinction-là que je peux rejeter. Parce que je ne crois pas qu'il y a la pensée intellectuelle d'un côté, la réflexion, et les sentiments de l'autre. Il n'y a pas une distinction à faire entre réflexion toute seule et sentiment de l'autre côté, mais d'ordinaire, quand nous réfléchissons sur ce qu'il faut faire, c'est à travers des sentiments que nous avons à l'égard de la situation où nous nous trouvons. Right? Mais les sentiments sont là, la fonction qu'ils jouent est d'être un instrument, un organe pour nous informer des états de choses qui sont pertinents pour notre action. Donc, quand j'ai dit que je ne fais pas grand état des sentiments, c'est que je ne crois pas que les sentiments expliquent des choses que la pensée réfléchissante à elle ne suffit pas d'expliquer. C'est plutôt que les sentiments sont un médium à travers lequel nous réfléchissons. Oui. Donc, pour le dire tout simplement, j'ai une théorie, une conception cognitive des émotions et des sentiments. C'est une façon de s'apercevoir, de percevoir le monde. Et c'est justement à cause de cela qu'il n'y a pas de distinction radicale à faire entre réflexion d'un côté et sentiment de l'autre. Quand nous réfléchissons de façon impartiale même, c'est régulièrement à travers des sentiments. Il y a des sentiments d'impartialité. C'est pas que il y a des sentiments partiels aussi, une haine viscérale pour quelqu'un de spécifique. Oui. Mais aussi, il y a quelque chose comme l'amour pour l'humanité en tant que tel. Il y a des sentiments impartiaux que nous éprouvons. Donc c'est ça que, si je ressens une certaine réserve à l'égard des théories sentimentales de la morale, c'est que d'ordinaire, ce sont des théories qui disent que la réflexion, les croyances, etc., les parties intellectuelles de l'esprit ne suffisent pas pour expliquer le comportement humain en général, moral en particulier. Il faut injecter, il faut aussi que les sentiments jouent un rôle. Et quand on fait une sorte de distinction de cette sorte, entre d'un côté la pensée intellectuelle et de l'autre le sentiment, on est réduit à avoir une conception du sentiment comme quelque chose de brut, quelque chose de non-pensant.
alors que moi, je suis persuadé que les sentiments pensent, plutôt que nous pensons à travers les sentiments. Donc, ce que je rejette, c'est cette conception de l'esprit, intellect d'un côté et sentiment de l'autre. L'esprit est un tout. Et les sentiments sont un médium dans lequel nous pensons, nous réfléchissons.
J'aurais tendance à être d'accord, mais il y a quelques passages quand même qui suggèrent une division dans la liste. En tout cas, s'il n'y a pas d'autres questions, merci beaucoup.
Oui, merci à vous.